Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another episode of Blood, Sweat, and Strife, Free Palestine Edition. My name is May, and my pronouns are she, they. And today we have a guest who is joining us. This is somebody that people who have been listening to the show for a long time may already be familiar with, because he was the first guest that we ever had on the show, and the first episode that we ever published was our interview with him. And we're really excited to have him back. So go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name is Hamza, pronouns he, him, and it's good to be here again.
Yeah, it's really great to have you. We got a really great response from the last time when you came on the show. So I think today's discussion and our topics will be really interesting and illuminating, and you're always just such a good resource of information on these things. So
thank you. I'm excited to get started.
Yeah, I'm excited to get into it. So the first thing I wanted to ask you today is just, how have you been doing over the past 6 months, and how have you been holding up?
I mean, you know, we are in drastically different Palestine is in drastically different conditions than you know, the last time I was on. I'm doing as well as I can be. Whenever, you know, I despair or feel horrible about what's happening and everything, I still understand I'm in a much better position than Palestinians in the homeland, and thus it's my responsibility to keep speaking out for them and keeping an advocate for them. I can't say I feel good on a day-to-day basis. It's, you know, Palestine is really just on the forefront of my mind every day, unless I'm distracted by something. It's Ramadan, which has been good. It's a good time of community, and it's also a very tumultuous time in Palestine. And it's also a time in Palestine during Ramadan. It tends to be a moment where, or a time where, people get very active and very energetic, despite, you know, being, you know, despite fasting all day every day. But I'm solid, I guess. You know, I can't say I'm completely fine, but holding up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. I mean, obviously, this is probably hitting you a lot harder than it's hitting me, because you're more directly related to the circumstances. But I think about it every day. I think about the death toll going up, what the IDF has been doing, what the United States is doing abroad, and how we are, or how our government is aiding in the terrorism which is being carried out by Israel. And it's heartbreaking. I still find reasons to be hopeful in spite of all that, but yeah. It's very hard. And this isn't something that I had written down, but something that I've been thinking about a lot lately is that trauma tends to have a very almost blurring effect on time. It feels October 7th didn't happen all that long ago, because we're still living through the retaliation to it. And when you're just consistently being traumatized, as whether you are directly experiencing it or you are somebody who is witnessing it, it's very hard to heal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's, we're going on month 6 now, since October 7th. And I think a lot of progress has been made, in terms of, you know, the general international outlook on the situation. I think huge swaths of people have been radicalized, and at the very least pushed to be scrutinous of their government. Even people who are regular liberals are still very, very critical of the US government now. Mm-hmm. That being said, especially as we near election season, we're gonna see a lot of people kind of go back on that, in terms of being we have to stop Trump, we have to stop fascism, even though we're already there. It's what keeps me hopeful is, not only have so many people been educated, but we might have talked about this before, but I remember activism for Palestine, like when I was a kid in the 2000s, I remember like international, especially Western sentiment about Palestine years ago. And it was nowhere near the same amount of support that Palestine enjoys now. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it's happened after the militant resistance in Palestine has executed the most successful operation in its time. Even now, Israel tries to keep putting out this narrative that they have full control of the Gaza Strip, but there's still missile launches and still confrontations and still, you know, guerrilla warfare going on across the entire strip. But yeah, things have changed a lot, but it's, you know, it's still ongoing, and it's, you know, it's sometimes it can be disheartening, but you know, revolutionary optimism is a must. So
exactly, yeah. I think that, not to get like too deep into the weeds and not to say anything that YouTube might not like, but I do feel like for a lot of people, seeing what is happening in Palestine right now is very similar to the experience of a lot of boomers seeing the Vietnam War, because they are watching an anti-colonial struggle which utilizes the tactics of guerrilla warfare, and they are realizing that the struggle against colonialism abroad is linked to the broader struggle against the people at home who are seeking to take away our rights and keep us in a position where we are basically enslaved to them. So like when it comes to how all of this is like interconnected, like I have another friend, he came on the show and said this, for Palestinians, the United States and Israel, it's all part of the same seven-headed dragon. It's all part of the same sort of imperialist connection. And as people become more educated and more aware of these things, they become more radicalized against these things which they're seeing carried out every day. And they start wanting to not support those things, which is why like targeted boycotts are so important right now and so big right now. And like a lot of companies have actually really been feeling the squeeze because of it.
Yeah. You know, popular sentiment for Palestine is higher than ever historically. But you know, the struggle is a long one, and I think a lot of people, even if they've learned about it for the first time in the past 6 months, are finally realizing like, man, this is something different. I think a lot of people, once they wake up to this, you know, your life doesn't really go back to being the way it was.
Exactly.
You can't really look at things the same way.
Yeah, it really is like, it's one of those things where like I feel like there have been tectonic shifts over the past 6 months just in popular consciousness and how the narrative is looking. Like the media doesn't really report on what's going on the ground at home very often. But if you are like keeping up with like activists and stuff on social media, you will see like a lot of like action being taken. You'll see demonstrations, you'll see protests, you'll see people shutting down like weapon shipments to Israel. And it's all very encouraging. Because like I think that as things go on, people will realize more and more just how powerful they are. And an actual infrastructure will be in place to shut things down ourselves. If the ruling class is not willing to do it for us.
Totally. I think in general, activism in the West is not as intense as it should be, but at the very least, it's very visible.
It is. So. Yeah. So, something I wanted to speak to you about on today's episode is that since we last spoke, Israel has not only been bombing Gaza and the West Bank, but also countries such as Lebanon and Syria, and the United States has been carrying out strikes against Yemen in an attempt to punish them for the actions of the Houthi rebels. Israel has made and continues to make a lot of enemies, and with concerns that this may spill over into a regional war, what does this mean not only for Palestinians, but for those living in the broader region?
Yeah, so something to clarify first is that Israel has not, like, they're not to start bombing Lebanon and Syria, like, recently. This is something they've always done over the years.
Mm-hmm.
They'll always use the excuse of, oh, like, you know, resistance rockets are coming from that direction, so we strike them. And they've done that in Lebanon and Syria for a while now. And that's because Lebanon, especially Lebanon, has some of the most active resistance outside of Palestine. And Syria also to a smaller extent. And even then, even also Iraq has resistance forces that manage to send rockets over to Israel here and there. That's something that's always been happening. And I think it's the very nature of it is an example of how Israel is always the antagonist, but yet still victimizes itself. And in terms of the United States striking Yemen, something to clarify about the Yemen situation. First of all, the Houthi rebels, they prefer to be called Ansar Allah. And that's because that's their official name. Houthi rebels is kind of like a more informal, almost derogatory name for them. But
I was actually unaware of that. Thank you for letting me know.
If you look up Ansar Allah, you'll find stuff about the Houthis. A lot of people use the terms interchangeably, but like they prefer, I think that's their official name. So, but yeah, something about Ansar Allah. The area they controls are about over, like, I think 85% of the population of Yemen. So they are de facto the administration of Yemen. The internationally recognized government of Yemen I don't think they're even in the country still, but they're basically just U.S., Saudi, and Emirate puppets. But I have immense pride and gratitude for the resistance in Yemen, and because they're probably the only country officially that has taken such direct action against the occupation. And their blockading efforts in the Red Sea, and now expanded to the Indian Ocean, are just extremely effective in terms of affecting the global economy. Mm-hmm. And there's only two languages capitalists understand. It's profit and violence. And if you don't speak one, you got to speak the other. And Yemen has done an excellent job at keeping up the sustained direct action in that region. Eilat, the Israeli port that's in the very southern part of the occupied interior, the port that's actually in contact with the Red Sea, is basically empty. The entire population is almost gone. Boats haven't been able to dock there for pretty much the entirety of Yemen's operations. And it's a major, major effect on the Israeli economy, especially because Eilat, that region, is not only just, you know, a cargo port, but it's also a spot of tourism. And something about these rocket strikes that all different resistance factions from all across the region have been able to keep sustained is that they make these settlements and these ports and these areas not safe to live in anymore. Mm-hmm. Hezbollah in the north, I think a lot of people really underestimate how much of an effect Hezbollah has. Over 500,000 settlers have fled the country by now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, absolutely. And but in the north alone, it's about 230,000. All those settlements are decimated in terms of population. They've all been internally displaced. A lot of them are staying in hotels further deeper in the interior, and it's all on the government's dime. On top of that, these settlements will never be safe again. Like, they're always in range of rockets. Hezbollah has been able to pass and disable the Iron Dome on multiple occasions, and their work in the north, They've very explicitly said, you know, Israel has a pattern of always trying to cover up his losses. Obviously,
mm-hmm.
That's especially the case in Gaza. But we hear almost entire complete radio silence from them in the north. And Hezbollah recently came out with a claim that they estimate they've eliminated about 2,000 casualties on the Israeli side in the north. Because every single day, if you're on Telegram and you see their updates, every single day they're doing rocket strikes against military bases, against barracks, against settlements. And it's something that, like, they've been able to sustain, especially since they have such higher numbers and such greater resources than, you know, the resistance in Gaza, which is blockaded on all sides. And although the resistance in Gaza specifically has been incredible in terms of how far they've come and how effective they are, it cannot be overstated just how much help having a whole second front in the north by Hezbollah has been. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's I think you've mentioned, like, you know, the possibility of a regional war. Israel will always talk big talk no matter what, but they do not want a regional war, and America also does not want a regional war. If Israel ever actually has to launch an invasion into Lebanon, it is not going to go well for them. They got kicked out of Lebanon last time they tried that, and even in Gaza they struggle to hold on to what they have. On top of this, the sustained economic effect of Yemen's actions, compounded with the military actions in the north from Hezbollah and the military actions in Gaza, have created a huge burden on the Israeli economy and society. You know, in Gaza, at this point, they have targeted over 1,000. I'm not sure what the number is anymore, but countless armored vehicles, whether they're APCs or tanks, and disabled tons of them. And when they strike these, you know, these vehicles with their rockets, if they don't kill them, they definitely injure them. And every injured soldier, every disabled soldier is someone that has to be actively fed and healed and taken care of in a hospital and rehabilitation center in the occupied interior. And these are people who can't work anymore, people who can't fight anymore, and people that have to be kept alive begrudgingly by the Israeli occupation.
Yeah.
so Israeli society as a whole, it will never be the same again. The security of the state will never be the same again. Netanyahu, who is, you know, the one of the furthest right candidates there is, and is probably one of the compromised candidates compared to how many other far right candidates there are in Israel. His whole thing was being Mr. Security. You know, he'll do all this horrible anti-democratic shit, but as long as he keeps the state secure, it's fine. He can't keep the state secure. His popularity has plummeted to like record low levels. Settlers are constantly protesting against him in Tel Aviv. And although they aren't protesting against Zionism, they're protesting against their own, you know, president. They want someone who's more effective, who can kill Palestinians more effectively, or who can do it in a more polite manner. One or the other.
Yeah.
Whether they're liberal Zionists or far-right Zionists, they all hate the guy. He sucks. And that's good for us, you know. I'm not going to say I have solidarity with Israeli protesters. As long as they fly the Israeli flag, I definitely don't want to be associated with them, period. But the more internal turmoil the occupation suffers, the better.
Yeah.
Because not only are they fracturing on the inside, but their entire military apparatus is, you know, under constant strain. And when it's under constant strain, it's also constant funds it's receiving from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something that's been very clear to a lot of people over the course of the past 6 months who learn about Palestine and also learn about how much support America gets is that, you know, the occupation cannot maintain their existence. They cannot maintain their level of aggression that they normally put out without the United States support. If the United States cut out all military support, all aid in general, Israel would collapse very quickly. And people say, oh, they only, you know, do a small part of their GDP. I mean, like, it's every military budget in every country has a small part of their, you know, GDP. It can't be understated how militarized, how aggressively racist and fascist Israeli society is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even though America sends so much money to Israel, and Israel has such a high budget for Hasbara, their propaganda, and their relations with the world, just the fact that Israelis, like Israeli citizens, have access to the internet, like, undoes all of that shit. no one has a positive opinion of like Israeli citizens. They're actively, there's a huge civilian effort to block aid trucks going into Gaza from the Israeli side. And that's more apparent than ever. Every other day, it's like you see some video of an Israeli in blackface just doing something racist. Like it's crazy.
It is legitimately fucking insane watching these people like play the victim card as they just do menstrual show shit. Like,
Even the other Israelis who call them out online, they don't call them out for being racist. They call them out for saying like, hey, you're making us look bad.
Exactly.
Don't do this. It's like the anti-Semites are going to call us racist. Like,
yeah,
it's anti-Semitic to call you racist for doing blackface. And like, dude,
it's insane. There was that one fucking lady who was posting in like a Facebook group, and she was saying like, she was posting pictures of this makeup that her husband, who is an IDF soldier, brought back for her from Palestinians, and basically, like, real, like, spoils of war shit. And everybody in the comments was just like, this doesn't make us look good. You should really delete this. And it's just like, they're just so concerned about their self, about the image that they're projecting.
And that image has been shattered forever now, too. Like, even, like, on a diplomatic international level, they've received condemnation from so many governments, even ones that, like, have been supporting them historically.
Yeah.
And now, even if, like, those governments still begrudgingly support them, the people never will. Like, we've seen such huge, concentrated, popular efforts to denounce Israel and march down the streets and for the sake of Palestine. And Israeli tourists are, like, ostracized. They're the worst people to ever, like, the worst kind of tourists you can encounter. There's some video of, I've been seeing a lot of activism in Japan, of all places, which was very surprising for me. And this is one video of this Japanese activist, like, protesting Palestine. These two Israelis go up to them and, like, start yelling at them and calling them, you know, anti-Semitic, whatever, and, like, telling them to shut up and everything. And it's like, you're in someone else's country and telling them to stop speaking out in their own country. Like, get the fuck out of here. Like, it's, I've seen a lot of parallels where, like, people who remember apartheid era South Africa saying, like, yeah, you know, the way Israeli tourists are seen around the world now is, like, how, you know, white South African tourists were in the same way.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, it's, I think the facade of the IOF and Mossad has been shattered forever. Every now and then there's reports in Iran or Lebanon or Turkey of, like, Mossad agents getting caught or spy rings getting caught and arrested en masse. Israeli soldiers have terrible operational security. Like, they always post about, like, where they're at, like, in Gaza, or, like, what they're doing.
That shit's so funny.
And, like, dude, and there are dozens and dozens and dozens of images and videos of Israelis looting homes.
Yeah.
Like cracking open safes and, like, looking through drawers and, like, stealing jewelry and shoes and everything. And, like, they'll post about it. Their families will post about it too.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, yeah, I just got these shoes from Gaza for my wife. Or, like, oh, here's me engaging to my fiance while blowing up a neighborhood. And, like, the obsession with the sexualization of Palestinian women, objectification of Palestinian women, where they are posting, where they literally hang up their lingerie and underwear, like, out in the street on the power lines on barbed wire. They wear them for some reason. They wear them and take pictures of them. Like, oh yeah, look, we're owning them by wearing their underwear.
What the fuck?
And it's, like, fucking crazy. And, like, yeah, it's wild. And this is one video where, like, one of them is one of these stormtroopers are looting a home, and they're pulling up all this lingerie and panties and stuff from this drawer, and, like, oh, look, I always knew Arab women were the sluttiest and shit like that. And it's like, this is not like, oh, this is one bad apple. This is a fuck ton of bad apples. The entire it's the entire orchard is fucking shitty.
It's like classic colonialism shit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is the result of a dedicated, concentrated effort to dehumanize an entire people, to constantly tell your people that you are superior to these inferior people. Even though they were here already, they don't belong here. They're worse than you, and you are superior to them. And that brings us to, like, the very existence of these Zionist state as a whole. Like, you can't claim to be a Jewish state and also claim to be a democratic state at the same time. Because if the Jewishness of your state takes precedence over the democratic nature of your state, then you have to cross democracy in order to sustain the Jewishness of your state. For example, it's very important for demographics in the state of Israel, the occupation, to maintain a Jewish majority. And even though the UN has explicitly said that Palestinian refugees and diaspora deserve the right of return and must be given the right of return, Israel completely disregards this, because who gives a shit about international law? And the issue Israel disregards this is because if they let all the Palestinians back in that they expelled, that is millions of Palestinians, millions. One, Israeli citizens will be outnumbered. And two, if these Palestinians are given, voting rights, what's stopping them from voting out all the systems that enable settler colonialism? What's stopping them from voting out Zionism as a whole? And thus it is no longer this quote-unquote Jewish state.
Yeah.
So you can't be both a democratic state and also an ethno state, because one has to be sacrificed for the other. And that's very apparent. And I think, you know, at first, a lot of the sympathy for Palestine is mostly just sympathy, like just pity. But I think many, many people, more than ever, have adopted a more radical and critical approach of the very nature of the Zionist occupation to begin with.
Yeah.
And You know, I think we probably said this a lot last time, but, you know, there are decades where nothing happens and weeks where decades happen. And the education of mass swaths of people about Palestine is just huge. Just happened at such a huge scale across the world. And whatever sort of, you know, facade they had before is gone. And I'm happy to see that. And I think that's one of the reasons why Israel lashes out so much, and why they're just dedicated to just committing horrible, horrible crimes against humanity. It's because I think they see the writing on the wall. I think they see like the fractures in their foundation. I think they see like this shit is not sustainable anymore, and something's got to give. You know, I think in general colonialism is not a very sustainable model, and we're seeing the results of that.
No, it's really not. Like, I think that every colonial enterprise has sort of this like natural lifespan. Some last longer than others. Some can last hundreds of years. Eventually, it just kind of collapses because they're spending so many resources just on keeping the local population in check, and. There's always resistance movements against this stuff, which puts these governments who carry out these things in a very precarious position, to say the least, because like their power could be taken away from them at any moment. And it makes more sense to cultivate friendly relations with these nations and enter into like mutually beneficial agreements. But that's not the way you get resources extracted, and that's not the way you keep the profit margins very wide. Just as it's been the case in apartheid South Africa and Vietnam and so many other colonized places, Palestine will eventually be free. Like, I don't think that what they're doing right now is sustainable in the slightest.
Not at all. And it's a good example of how the... Okay, so Hassan Kanafani, who was a... I might have talked about this last time, but he's a very prominent Palestinian author, revolutionary, one of the founders of the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the largest communist resistance faction in Palestine. Mm-hmm. And he wrote about how in the settler economy, in the colonial economy, it is the natural tendency of settler society to just drift rightwards, to become more fascist over time. Even though some of the initial Zionist movements in Palestine, even the ones who did the Nakba, were labor Zionist movements. They try to dress it up as a leftist movement, but overall it's colonial in nature. The fact that they prioritize this, you know, Jewish only labor in the occupied interior, that ends up resulting in a situation where it pushes society rightwards as a whole, because no matter what, this one ethnicity, this one ethnic group is superior to this other ethnic group, and that is the paramount principle of your state. And as long as that's the case, Your people are going to drift rightwards all the time.
Oh, definitely.
And we see this in every strata of Israeli society, whether they're kids, or whether they're men or women, whether they're working class, or whether they're, you know, richer. They are actually taking part in the oppression and extirpation of Palestinians. And we see this when Israeli civilians, quote unquote civilians, are blocking off these humanitarian aid trucks, where there are hundreds of trucks waiting to get into Gaza, and they're being held up because these Israelis go and they block the roads and they put tents up and they put bouncy houses and they have fucking barbecues and shit. It's reminiscent of like lynching parties in the United States, where it became a family event, you know, to actively support the starvation and execution of these people. It's not just, it's just the bad government. It's just Netanyahu. It's the nature of the state. It's the nature of the settlers. To be a settler is not just to live in a country and you are, you know, this country had settler colonial roots and you just live here. To be a settler is to have a specific relationship with a state in which you actively benefit and actively support and maintain the ethnic cleansing of the indigenous population. Every Israeli citizen is complicit to some extent. Not only are they all conscripted into the military and thus have, you know, weapons and training and carry weapons on them at all times, but they also they also live on these settlements that were built over the ruins of Palestinian villages. Mm-hmm. and the kibbutz who have this sort of PR image as being, oh, these nice leftist communes where they have, you know, collective property and they just like live there farming all peacefully. Not only were these built over destroyed Palestinian villages, but they're used as sort of a first line of defense to surround Palestinian areas to be like, okay, if these Palestinians ever act out, they're going to kill these people first. And then they're going to get to, you know, the main big cities that we actually care about. And that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened on October 7th. Every settlement in Palestine, which, by the way, is a very polite thing to call it, is really just a militarized outpost with you know, of course, a quote-unquote civilian side of the city to, you know, support it. These towns and these settlements are just, they always have military presence, and they're always in the way of like any sort of military confrontation. We saw on October 7th how Israeli Apache helicopters and tanks indiscriminately fired upon these settlements, not knowing where the militants were, because their entire security apparatus sort of fell apart that day. They fired tank rounds into houses and entire neighborhoods in these kibbutz and these settlements. Their roofs are gone. Their entire like tops of these buildings are gone because they were destroyed by Apache helicopter missiles from the very top. And it goes to show how like settlers, despite being a vital aspect of the settler colonial project, are just a resource for them. It's just these people are expendable. If they die, they can be used for propaganda, and if they live, they're just another stormtrooper.
And something that I'd like to briefly touch on, since it came out, the news broke in between the last time we recorded together and now, Israel knew that Hamas was going to attack on October 7th. And they still went ahead and scheduled a festival for that location anyways. Like, that just reads as legitimately very, like, it feels like a coordinated event, right?
Well, I don't want to go too far into the conspiracy side of this thing. Okay. Because I think some of that narrative is sort of like defends the intelligence and military in a sense. Because they're like, oh, you know, it couldn't be that our military and intelligence failed. They must be in on it, you know?
Yeah.
It's what happened was that the colonial entity just got so arrogant and so complacent that even though they had intel that indicated that the resistance was planning some big operation, they weren't sure exactly when or exactly where or what it would entail. They just knew they were training intensely and had, you know, plans for something. When it was given to them, they just denied it. They're like, nah, they're not capable of doing that. There's no way they can do that.
Okay.
And it really wasn't an aspect of like, oh, we know this is going to happen, we're going to let it happen. I think it was more so that, nah, they're Palestinians and they're in Gaza and we keep them starving. You know, how can they do this? Whatever. And they disregarded it. So although they had intelligence to indicate something was going to happen, I truly think it was just a complete failure of the security apparatus in the occupation altogether. And if Al Jazeera recently put out their investigative documentary about October 7th, and something about interviews with, you know, helicopter pilots in the occupation on that day was that they had no intel to work off of. They had sightings, and they literally joined local WhatsApp groups to try to find targets.
Wow.
Like, oh, where, like, these cars going this way? Are they like resistance fighters? Are they settlers? What's going on? And like, that's where they got their intel from. And I think it was over almost 30 corpses, 27 or 29 bodies were found in between the settlements and Gaza, meaning they were on the way from settlements to Gaza, meaning they're likely hostages. And those are just the ones that are in between the settlements and Gaza itself, meaning these were hostages being taken back and Israeli helicopters fired upon them because they just saw targets to hit. Not to mention the, you know, military response to the settlements themselves, where there were dozens of other Israeli citizens killed, the testimonies of settlers who were either hostages and got rescued or just survived the events of that day, seeing their military like absolutely just rain bullets upon them and their neighbors and stuff. And it's part of this informal policy of the IOF called the Hannibal Directive, where they would rather have a dead soldier than a captured soldier, because not only is that a security risk, but also that captured soldier can be exchanged for hundreds of Palestinian prisoners.
Yeah.
And so even though they claim, oh, it's you know, it's not really our policy anymore, it's informal, they still maintain it to this day. Like, it's still something they carry out, because that's what they are. Settlers are resources to them. People are expendable. And all that matters is the sustaining of this colony and increasing profit margins. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely, yeah. thank you for providing that clarification, because, like, I just almost went full Bush to 9/11 for a moment.
it's been a common sentiment amongst a lot of people. Yeah. But something in general to keep in mind is that give credit to the resistance where it's due. Definitely. A lot of people are into hating Israel, but not really into knowing much about the resistance or understanding the resistance. And so that's the kind of the natural conclusion. I can see where that comes from. But in general, like, it's good. It's good to maintain this, you know, credit to the resistance where they do shit.
Definitely, yeah.
But yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I saw a very good phrase yesterday about the resistance, and it basically went like, saying that you hate settler colonialism while also condemning the resistance to that settler colonialism is like saying that you hate a disease, but you also hate the antidote.
Absolutely. Because support in abstract means nothing without support in practice. And you can't support oppression without supporting... you can't hate oppression without supporting the resistance to that oppression, regardless of how it looks. And regardless of what any resistance group can possibly do, nothing can change the fact that the very nature of the Palestinian movement is that they have the right to self-determination, and that must be realized. And as long as they have that right, resistance will continue. And if you don't want the resistance to be ugly, if you don't want the violence to continue, liberation must happen. Mm-hmm. People always say, like, oh, we should support peace. Peace between two equal countries fighting, sure, but not in the case of an oppressor and the oppressed. Something many liberals struggle to understand is, you know, power structures. They think racism is just being mean to someone else for their race. Kwame Ture once said, if a white man hates me and wants to kill me, that's his problem. But if he hates me and has the power to kill me, now it's my problem. Mm. Racism gets its power from capitalism. But the reality is that in the case of, you know, Palestine, there is a simple relationship between the settler population and the indigenous population. The occupier, the occupied. The oppressor, the oppressed. Peace for the oppressor is not peace for the oppressed. Peace for the slave is not peace for the slave master. You know, if people are oppressed and you call for peace, all you're calling for is a continuation of the status quo. And as long as people are oppressed, that peace will not last long.
Yeah.
What you're asking for is capitulation. So in order for there to be true, long-standing peace, it has to be preceded by justice and liberation. Otherwise, that's not peace. That's a temporary truce until the next reignition of violence happens. Mm. But yeah, it's I think the resistance is still working, still going strong. We're still seeing daily operations against military positions in Gaza Strip. In the Gaza Strip, the West Bank is on fire. Resistance cells are not only unified in the West Bank, but they're still pretty active as well. And they always respond to these Zionist military raids into the cities across the West Bank, and like Nablus and Ramallah and Jenin, and Tul Karam. It's wild. Very recently, the resistance in Tul Karam was celebrating because they did a successful operation that killed at least 4 Israeli soldiers. Mm. And those are the small victories that they really was celebrating there, because in the West Bank, they are surveilled much, much more intensely. And not only do they have to worry about the occupation, they have to worry about the Palestinian Authority, which is the collaborator regime that maintains security coordination with the occupation. And so it's they have less opportunity to train. They have less opportunity to be open about the resistance. They have to take a much more kind of like hidden guerrilla resistance cell format rather than the much more organized and disciplined format that, you know, resistance in Gaza has. But they're a vital part of it as well. And it's made it clear to the occupation that this shit won't be tolerated anymore. And just like the casualties on these Israeli casualties are being covered up, and not only in the north, not only in Gaza, but they're also being covered up in the West Bank. Because regularly we'll see videos of like civilian onlookers seeing these APCs and bulldozers get destroyed by IEDs. Like we'll see a bulldozer just burst into flames, just destroyed by a locally made explosive device. But you don't see Israel say anything about acknowledging that.
No.
You don't. And at all. And you know, in Gaza, Israel tries to keep a sort of trickle on like the reports of the casualties. They'll admit to like one or a couple deaths a day, maybe. And they only announce the officers. Everyone in the fucking Israeli military is an officer for some reason. And all the casualties are just like, oh, corporal this, lieutenant this. like, it's crazy. Staff sergeant this. Like, they're like the only, like, if you're telling me you're only announcing the deaths of these officers, where the fuck are the, what about the grunts that they're commanding? Like, are none of them getting killed whatsoever? They do that to sort of have this facade of like, oh yeah, we're just, you know, reporting the most, I guess, important deaths. I guess that's what they're implying. But at the same time, they don't have to announce every single death happening there. And like we said about operational security earlier, fucking soldiers, they suck at that. There's a video of an Israeli soldier. He uploaded the inside of what an APC looked like after they got hit by an RPG. And you hear fire burning in the background. They're all like bloody and fucked up and shit. And it's like five of them in there. And it's like, wow, what a great idea to fucking post online for the world to see how shitty you are. Like how this facade of like invincibility that Israel's always trying to maintain for its military is just gone now.
Yeah.
And I think we're not going to see the effects of the military operation in Gaza on the civilian population in Israel for a very long time, I think, for a while. I don't know if we'll ever see the true casualty numbers until, you know, Israel collapses, but all these people, like I said before, are fully funded by the state to go through rehabilitation, to go through, you know, physical therapy, to be taken care of in these hospitals. And they're a huge burden on the economy. Mm-hmm. All the reserve brigades at this point in Gaza have been pulled out, and it's just mainly frontline troops, like actual soldiers. And there's a relatively recent resistance video. One of the APCs that got destroyed was a model from the 1960s. Like, this isn't a reserve brigade. This is supposed to be a main, like, frontline assault brigade. And they have an APC from the 1960s. Like, you don't field equipment from the Cold War unless you're, like, you have a shortage. Unless like, you are not doing good in terms of supplies.
Yeah.
And that's been very apparent. And the resistance, according to a statement from Iran, in Gaza at least, is allegedly like around 80% capacity in terms of what they have stockpiled in terms of munitions. So they're not going anywhere anytime soon. And although the effects on the civilian population in Gaza is horrible, I always get hope from the Algerian movement, which got independence after 132 years of occupation. I see hope from Iraqis, who many of which, although, you know, Iraq is still in dire conditions to this day, many of which are finally seeing semblance of like peace and like living normal lives, even after going through such horrible conditions. Mm-hmm. Palestine, in terms of like frequency, how quickly deaths have amounted in Gaza, they still haven't faced conditions as dire as Algeria or Vietnam or Iraq yet. And I think it's through these moments where, you know, we see these mass deaths that are finally pushing politicians left, or finally pushing huge swaths of the population leftwards, and to take a more anti-imperialist stance. Mm-hmm. It's taken a lot for that to happen. But I think this is where we learn the meaning of revolutionary sacrifice, where it's either you're oppressed and you die slowly forever, for the indefinite future, for infinity, or you might see a devastating war, but the mass radicalization of millions of people around the world to be in support of your cause. Mm-hmm. I think the most important thing you can do is just maintain faith for the resistance, because that's really Palestine's only hope. And Palestine isn't going to be freed by, like, you know, us marching in the streets. It's not going to be freed by Congress or, you know, any other UN resolution. It's going to be freed by the resistance first and foremost. And the resistance is the manifestation of Palestinian people's right to self-determination and right to sovereignty. That's how it manifests. And when Palestine is freed, when a free Palestinian state is formed, it's going to be formed through the actions of the resistance. It's not going to be formed through diaspora kids like me marching around, you know. It's good, I guess, like, we have to be advocates and like, you know, build support for the resistance in the West. But I think what's important for us is to push more radical sentiment, you know.
Definitely.
If we can't be radical in our tactics, which, you know, it would result in the shutting down factories and fucking, like, you know, locking up, like, arms manufacturers and, like, securing boats and stuff, which we don't really see that much here, but we see a lot more in, like, the UK, for example, in Europe. We can't do that. At the very least, you need to maintain a more radical rhetoric, a more radical stance on things, you know? And we have to normalize that.
Yeah. Resistance is not terrorism. And a point that I wanted to make, even though you've already kind of made it, is, like, all oppressor states attempt to project this image of themselves that they are all powerful and that they know they are omniscient and they have the power to basically do whatever they want to you. But their power only goes so far, and they only have so many people, they only have so many resources, they only have so many checks that the United States is willing to cut them. It may seem like the United States is this, like, invincible, like flush with cash kind of country. And in some ways we are, like, flush with cash. But we're really not. And we've been defeated before. I think in the end, like, most anti-colonial struggles will be successful so long as they are sustained by a core of people who are willing to put in the effort and the work to make sure that their country is decolonized.
Yeah. And also that's where, like, you know, in terms of our side of things and our sides of, you know, resisting or at least protesting and protesting against, you know, Zionism, that's where the BDS movement comes into play. Because even the consumers have a role.
Yeah.
The only way people are going to, you know, divest from the occupation is if it becomes if it becomes too expensive to do so. That's what happened in South Africa. People stopped supporting South Africa because it was no longer profitable.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way you can convince, you know, institutions to pull out. You say, we're all going to fucking stop buying from you if you keep supporting this occupation. And we've seen numerous colleges, universities divest from the occupation, which is a huge
one. Yeah.
Every cent every dollar that's a burden on the Israeli economy is a win. Every dollar they lose is a win. And I think Israeli society is spiraling, and they no longer have security. They no longer have a stable economy. And this, even though the GDP was so damn high, thanks to the injections of, you know, American capital, it's gonna be going down steadily, and it's not gonna last long. And even then, I really think the U.S. will always constantly back Israel until, like I said earlier, it becomes too expensive. It becomes too expensive. Like you know, you said there's only so many checks America will cash. They have a lot of those checks, you know, they will constantly keep cashing them, but at the end of the day, eventually it's going to get to a point where it's unsustainable. And like I said before, something's got to give.
Exactly.
But yeah.
Yeah. A friend of mine told me a funny story about a protest that he was at. And there was a speaker up there talking about the boycotts. And he was calling out Puma. And, like, a bunch of people in the crowd were looking at their clothes and going, like, oh, shit, I didn't know. So, yeah, like, there's a role for everybody to play in this struggle. If you're able to, join a radical organization, which is, active in the anti-imperialist movement at home. In my local area, I see a lot of stuff happening with YDSA, Workers World Party, Food Not Bombs, like, all these different coalitions. The Palestinian Youth Movement seems very, very good there. In North America, I know some Canadian members of it, but I believe they're also active in the United States. And yeah they are. And if you're able to, just like, you know, get involved, like do something to help.
Yeah, I actually had an organization here in Birmingham, a local one, called Young Palestinians of Birmingham. And we initially wanted to start a POAM chapter, a Palestinian Youth Movement chapter, but they're just hard to get a hold of in times like these right now. So we have a local org centered around activism. Our role is to educate, organize, and mobilize people. And we've organized numerous protests, numerous demonstrations. We've organized vigils. We've organized like documentary screenings and education events and stuff. And we collaborate with not only like, we collaborate with the local DSA chapter, we collaborate with the PSL, we collaborate with like even like, you know, student organizations. But recently at UAB, the University of Alabama in Birmingham, the USGA, the student, basically the student government senate, thanks to one of our board members at YPB, Young Palestinians Birmingham, was able to get them to issue a super pro-Palestinian like resolution to not only condemn Israel for like the its actions since October 7th, but set for the last 75 years. And that's an official stance of the student government body in, at this university now. And that's you know, that's huge.
Fantastic.
And even though these things like ceasefire resolutions and statements are really just symbolic victories, the symbolic victories still help us and challenge a narrative, you know? And anything we can do to ostracize Zionism, to make Zionists feel uncomfortable or you know, unsafe or just not, they can't be proud of the stance publicly. Anything we can do to push that is good, because it makes Zionism so much more unsustainable to have when it's when people are attacked socially for it. And that's really what we want. We need Zionism to be ostracized at every level of society.
Zionism and even, is cringe. And
yes, we have to convince everyone Zionism is cringe and Palestine is epic, and that's what we have to support. But yeah, we recently put up a, thanks to the contributions of, you know, local, you know, local people, we were able to put up a pro-Palestine billboard in Birmingham, in the heart of downtown Birmingham.
Yeah.
Everyone will see driving on the interstate, and we're raising funds for a second one now. And it's like, this is the first time in history we see that in Birmingham. And although I wish our tactics could be more radical, our beliefs are pretty radical, but our tactics are not, because given the certain conditions of our base here and what we can sustainably do, we're not as radical as I wish we could be. But we're still, you know, we're still out there. We still have a lot of visibility, and like we're growing. You know, we have we're meeting with the local city, we're meeting with other local activists, and we're building a name for Palestinians in Birmingham. But yeah, I think we need to see more direct action in the West. And especially in the United States. I know this is very difficult to do, and people's conditions are not bad enough to a point where we have much bigger numbers of people like willing to do that. But that's what it's going to take, I think, eventually. But at least in terms of, even if like immaterially, the oppressor has so many resources, so much capital against us. In terms of rhetoric, in terms of narrative, everything has shifted.
Yeah.
Things have changed forever. And Israel will never, ever regain its reputation after what's happened. And anybody who supports Israel publicly amongst their friends, especially amongst like the younger generation, is like, it's just insane. Zionists hate being associated with Nazis or being compared to Nazis, but they do a really fucking good job at doing shit similar to them. And if Zionists don't want to be compared to Nazis, we should keep doing that more. And you know, industrializing mass slaughter and extermination of an indigenous people, I don't know like how much worse you can fucking get. And it's good, you know. Although the older generations in America are much more supportive of Zionism, mostly because they don't know shit. Much like the younger generations, Gen Z and to a smaller extent millennials, pro-Palestinian sentiment is at an all-time high. Not just in support for a ceasefire, whatever that means, but also like just in general for Palestine as a whole. And it's important for us to maintain this these educational efforts.
Definitely.
And yeah.
Yeah. I have a lot of friends who have been going into like teach-ins and like protests and stuff, and they have my heart. I really support them, and I think that like Like what you said really does ring true. Like our beliefs are very radical, but our tactics aren't quite in line with that yet. Because like for a lot of people now, like we are coming to a point where we are supporting more radical action and holding more radical beliefs. It's just that we need to be careful about what we say and do because we are in a position right now where the government is already trying to make this sort of thing illegal. And while I'm not going to be the type of person where I'm going to say, like, you need to base your political action around what the response to that political action is going to be, I will say that you should definitely be very careful when expressing yourself on these issues and expressing or like articulating the type of future that you would like to see. But yeah, also like another thing that you said, like there has been like a huge shift in the culture. Like I meet people just randomly all the time now who are supportive of Palestine. And I wasn't seeing that just a few years ago. Like I was kind of vaguely aware of what was going on, and I knew some things, just from like what I had read and what I had heard mostly from you. But like now it seems like more and more people are coming onto the same page, which is great.
Yeah, definitely. It's like I say this all the time, but like having this much support is was unimaginable when I was a kid, much less 10 years ago, much less 5 years ago, you know. It's social media has changed everything in terms of everything is out in the open now, and it's so much easier to get the truth. It comes, you know, it's a double-edged sword because of how much misinformation there is, but at the same time, it's very, very empowering for a lot of people. And recently, we were flyering at a St. Patrick's Day parade. We were handing out flyers to for people to sign, basically a huge like people's resolution for free Palestine, basically. And knowing the difference in terms of the stance on Palestine between Irish people in Ireland and Irish Americans has always been, you know, very different. But I was very pleasantly surprised. We had an overwhelmingly positive response. Yeah, like there was like maybe a couple, like two or three people that like turned us down, maybe one person that like ignored us, whatever. But overall, everyone we talked to was very, very
That's
supportive.
great.
And they took our flyers and they signed up and everything. It was like that was very surprising for me. You know, like when people can not only sympathize with the Palestinian cause, but also connect themselves to it. It's you know, we live in radical changing times, and it's very hopeful. And although we need to be more radical in terms of tactic and action, it's like at least we know things will never be the same. And Israel is re being recognized every day more and more for the settler colonial state it is, and they can never ever regain their image.
Yeah, definitely. It the tide is turning against them, and like we were talking about earlier, like I feel like the majority of like the Arab world and like the Middle East like really just hate Israel. Like the Arab masses do like really hate Israel. Even like reactionary Arabs are tend to be anti-Zionist, and I think that like it bodes well for the cause of a free Palestine.
For sure. I think, yeah, the Arab masses historically pretty much almost overwhelmingly supported Palestine. There's, you know, there's not enough radical action from Arab countries either, in my opinion, except Yemen and Lebanon to an extent. But like the things need to be escalated. They have to get escalated. And countries like Jordan and Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and Egypt that are all collaborator countries in terms of their governments, they have to deal with these masses who were extremely, extremely against the government's policy on these things. And I truly think that we won't see help from these countries, genuine help for free Palestine from these countries, until we see revolutions in them. And like in the case of Jordan, especially, Jordan really is the main, it's the country, the country that borders Palestine entirely on the east side. So like it's if Jordan was replaced with a government that was anti-Zionist, that would be a huge, drastically detrimental. That'd have a huge detrimental effect on the state of Israel itself, because in order to get around the blockade Yemen has been maintaining, aid gets sent through the United Arab Emirates, and it gets shipped through three different countries: the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and in Jordan to send resources to Israel by land. Mm. That's how they get around it. So, like, these reactionary monarchies, these reactionary regimes, they support Israel because they have the same interests in line with each other. And until we see mass popular movements in Jordan, for example, overthrow these governments, we're not going to see much support from those states. I think if anything, the only thing that'll make Arab countries lean towards Palestine or support Palestine more materially is towards the end, when it becomes increasingly apparent that Israel is collapsing very soon. They're going to really, really, really fear the lack of forgiveness from the Palestinian people. Mm. You know, not to get all too religious on y'all for a second, but there's this hadith saying the most powerful dua, the most powerful prayer is the prayer of the oppressed. Mm. It is the most likely to be heard, to be fulfilled. And I can't think of many countries right now that are more oppressed than the Palestinian people.
Yeah.
And I truly think, like, when Palestine is free, you know, a lot of people are gonna have to reckon with the fact that they supported this Nazi adjacent regime for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And that's something people are gonna have to come to terms with, you know. I think a free Palestine is within our lifetimes, and it's becoming increasingly apparent every day.
Definitely. I do think that as we go further into this year and further into just the future, we will see a lot of stuff that is very heartbreaking, but also a lot of stuff that gives us a lot of hope. And I do think we'll continue to see these sort of tectonic shifts happening. Not only in Palestine, but all over the world. The international consensus is 100% against, well, not 100%, like half of the world is basically against Israel. And they really only have the backing of the West. And eventually,
sorry to jump in. Even that's kind of falling apart. Like France, of all fucking countries, has been like condemning Israel explicitly, even though that's all hollow, it's all platitudes. The very fact that they're willing to do that is showing that, like, okay, this sort of network of Western support is kind of crumbling, and really it's really just the United States. The moment that Israel is collapsing, I think many European countries will just fucking ditch them.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I definitely do believe that things will get better. It's I always use the analogy that's like that Simpsons bit where Chief Wiggum gets his necktie caught in the hot dog roller, and he's like, "This is gonna get a lot worse before it gets better," and and I think that's kind of how it's going to go. Like, there will be a lot of pain, but there will also be reasons to rejoice in our future.
Yeah. Have you seen the recent polls that came out of Palestine?
No, I don't believe so.
So there's this group called the it's this Palestinian survey group. They're active both in Gaza and the West Bank. And every few months they do a huge poll where they put out this huge survey where they explain how they got their sample, they explain who they're talking to and everything. But the most recent polls that 49% of Palestinians believe Hamas deserves to represent and lead the Palestinian people. Mm. And that includes both the entire West Bank and Gaza. Only 17% chose Fatah under the leadership of Mahmoud Abbas, who is the current collaborator president in the PA. Mm. And I think it was with the question, are you satisfied with the performance of Palestinian actors in the current war? 70% approval of Hamas. 61% of Yahya Sinwar, who is the leader of Hamas in Gaza, 27% of support of Fatah, which is the political party, ruling party in the PA, and 14% of Abbas. 64% expects Hamas to win the war with Israel. And in Gaza, expectations that Israel will win the war has dropped by one-third compared to 3 months ago. Almost two-thirds blame Israel for their suffering, and 20% blame the U.S. In Gaza, only 9%, a 10-point drop from the previous poll, blames Hamas. So even though things have gotten worse for the people in Gaza, if anything, support for Hamas has gone up.
Yeah.
There was a question. It was how would you vote in new parliamentary elections with the same nominees as in 2006? 47% support for Hamas, 22% for Fatah, and 9% for third parties. The question, who do you prefer to see in control of the Gaza Strip? 59% Hamas, 13% PA without Abbas, 11% PA with Abbas, 5% other. But in general, that means like majority support is there for Hamas, broadly at least. Support for armed resistance has gone up. Support for Mahmoud Abbas, the PA, the collaborator regime in the West Bank, has gone even further down. And it's not like the Palestinian people are suffering and they see this and they recognize this, but like that doesn't make them go back on their principles or values. If anything, it only strengthens them. And the silver lining to this intense oppression and brutal treatment of Palestinians in Gaza and across Palestine as a whole overall is the fact that, like, if anything, it's reaffirming their beliefs, showing that, like, yeah, no matter what we believe, this is what's going to happen to us. This is the nature of the occupation. And the fact that the people in Gaza can see on social media people like marching and supporting them across the world, that alone should be enough to keep us going. You know, if the people in Gaza, who face the worst conditions on earth, literally the worst humanitarian crisis on earth right now, if they refuse to give up, what fucking right do I have to give up, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I definitely feel a need to continue to consume information about this and to try my best to be a good advocate for these people, because they are facing seemingly like insurmountable circumstances. Families are getting torn apart, yet their resolve remains the same. Like, they are not going to go down without a fight. They are not going to quit easily. And I think that, like, being a good advocate at home is a good way of trying to aid in the struggle.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And you know, the fact that the Palestinian struggle was a generations long one, that alone is what makes it, I think, sustainable. Because my grandfather didn't get to return to Palestine, but you know, I hope my dad gets to, and even if he can't, I hope I get to.
Yeah.
And it's my job, that's my duty, that's my in Arabic it's amana, it's like a trust, a promise, but like that's what's I'm here for, you know. It's since October 7th, a lot of aspects of life just seem so like the materialistic aspects just seem so like meaningless. Like, why the I don't give a shit about my fucking job. I work a fucking corporate IT job. Like, who gives a shit? I don't care about like my money. Well, yeah, I need to have a certain amount of money to live, but like, I'm not stressing over saving up constantly and shit. Cause like, it's like, dude, I don't care, man. As long as it's for Palestine, I'll do anything. Like, I don't I have such little attachment now to like meaningless shit now. It's, like a free Palestine is really my main goal in life personally. That's like that's what I'm here for. I think that's the fight I've inherited, and it's the fight I want to see to the end. And I hope one day I can return and see my family again in El Yamun, and really just like live in a free Palestine. Even though I've grown up a privileged diaspora kid, you know, I hope I get to go back one day and stay there. But it's The Palestinian struggle has been going on for the past 75 years, at least the past 75 years. It's not going to end anytime soon, especially when you've seen other similar struggles go on for much longer and still win in the end. Like we said, it's the natural tendency of colonialism, of fascism, to crumble, to fall apart, and we will see justice at the end of the day.
Definitely. I love that sentiment, and I think that's actually very moving. I think now we'll get to the part where we wrap up. Thank you so much for coming on. Like, once again, this really is a pleasure, and I love talking to you about this stuff. Is there anything you'd like to plug real quick before we head out?
If you're interested in following our local activism in Birmingham, Alabama, of all places, you can follow us on Instagram at yp.bm. We're called the Young Palestinians of Birmingham. We have our hands in pretty much anything Palestine related in the city. Yp.bham on Instagram. Follow us.
I'll link that in the show.
Awesome. Thank you. And in terms of reading material, the best thing you can do at an individual level to support Palestine, to support the struggle overall, is to read, to educate yourself. Decolonizepalestine.com is a great online resource, a great introductory resource. Get into books. 10 Myths About Israel by Ilan Pape, an anti-Zionist Jewish historian. Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine by Ilan Pape, same guy. The 100 Years War on Palestine by Rashid Khalidi, another great book. The Battle for Justice in Palestine by Ali Abu Nima. Reading some Marxist theory will help you too, especially in the case of Strategy for the Liberation of Palestine by PFLP. That is a vital read, in my opinion. And On the National Question by Ibrahim Kepakeya, who was a Turkish communist who was executed in the 70s. But that's a really good idea of understanding what a nation is versus what a state is. And that's something really important for people to understand about Palestine. Keep in mind, the goal of a Palestinian liberation movement is not a two-state solution. It is not peace broadly, whatever that means. It is liberation. That is the goal. Palestine will be free from the river to the sea. A single unified state of Palestine, democratic, pluralistic state of Palestine. Where hopefully in the future, I believe, Arabs and Jews and Christians can live side by side with equal rights and obligations under the law. But for that to happen, we need to see justice for the Palestinian people. But yeah, get educated, join an organization if you can, and just do whatever you can to help the movement.
Totally agree.
Never stop talking about Palestine.
Yep. Yep, yeah. Keep talking about it, people. So yeah, we're gonna head out. This has been an episode. We'll see y'all later.
Bye.
Bye.